Today on the Grave Talks, White Christmas, Bloody Christmas. On Christmas Day 1929, the lives of an entire family came to an end. After eating Christmas lunch, Charlie Lawson murdered his entire family. Shotguns, rifles, and bodies bludgeoned with blunt objects were all found amongst the carnage of this horrific murder scene on Christmas Day. These events would shock and disturb everyone in the community, leaving them with more questions than answers. What led this man to take the lives of his supposed loved ones on a day that was typically reserved for family and celebration? Was there something dark at play that drove Charlie to perform such a despicable act? Today, we discuss White Christmas, Bloody Christmas with author of that very book, Trudy J. Smith.
People probably need to realize that there's actually two books that I wrote on this case. The first one was a result of my father's interest in the case. He was 8 years old when the murders happened, and he remembered it very well and how it affected him that day, that Christmas morning or afternoon, when word came, you know, that this terrible tragedy had happened, you know, about an hour drive away from where he lived in Thomasville. And he was fascinated by this story and bothered by it his entire life. And I remember him taking us, you know, we had gone on a trip up to the mountains. You know, it's something here in North Carolina, a lot of people living in the Piedmont did back then. And it's in the foothills where this story happened. And he brought us back by and showed us where the murders had happened. At that time, I was about 6 years old. And the Lawson cabin was still there. And I remember we drove up. And I could see the cabin. I wasn't overly interested in it, but I do remember seeing it standing out in the sunlight and the sagebrush. And it had, it was being used for hay storage. And so that day we couldn't go in it and look at it or anything. But anyhow, it just shows he had an interest all the time, all through my life. He would bring it up and talk about it. And, nobody really could understand what happened, what caused this man to kill his entire family on Christmas Day. It was just not something that happened as much maybe as it does now, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And so anyhow, he continued that interest. And when he retired at about age 65, he was still thinking about it, and he had developed some friends that lived up there in the area, and you know, of the murders, and you know, they would talk about it. It was a topic of conversation, you know, for two or three generations there. People would talk about it, and someone that he knew said, "Well, I know Charlie Lawson's best friend." They lived right there and worked with him, knew him. And my father was just very excited. He said, "Well, can I meet this person?" That person's name was Hillary Hampton. They called him Hill Hampton. And so my father met with him and got to talk to him and learned a lot, you know, from Hill Hampton about the Lawsons and how he knew them and everything. And one thing of note, it didn't stand out so much really then as to what it was going to end up being, but Hill Hampton told my father that first time he spoke with him that there was a problem in the family, and he knew what it was, but he didn't think it was his place to say anything about it or to tell anybody about it. Mm-hmm. And that kind of stuck in my father's head, you know, what is he talking about? And it wasn't too long after that, that stirred my father's interest up, and one thing led to another almost kind of magically. He ended up with a few pictures, and they were hard to come by. And so we went, well, he came back and talked to me about it, and he said, I'd like for you to go up there to that graveyard with me and look at the graves. And, you know, this is a family graveyard back in the woods with this mass grave and a large headstone and everything. And I said, well, that'll be interesting. You know, I'd love to go up there and see it with you. So we went up there, and I think the year was 1987, if I'm not mistaken. And we were looking at the tombstone. It was like a really dreary, rainy day. We were standing under an umbrella together. And I was reading the epitaph on the tombstone. And that tombstone says, not now, but in the coming years, it will be in a better land. We'll read the meaning of our tears, and then sometime we'll understand. And that just really struck me. I thought, that's a strange epitaph, and that it said that we'll read the meaning of our tears. Mm-hmm. And I asked my father, I said, has anybody ever tried to write a book about this? And he said, no. As I understand it, they'll try to kill you. The family will try to kill you if you try to write anything about it. I said, wow. I mean, you know.
Quite a warning.
Yeah. And they said, you know, some people tried it and were scared off of writing it. At that time in the late 80s, the murder was about 60 years old. And all the people that knew much of anything about it were now in their, you know, 80s or older. So at least 70s, you know.
Sure.
And I said, well, you know, I don't see any reason why anybody would be left that would be that opposed, you know, in this day and age of true crimes being written and that type of thing. And I was one of those people who didn't have money to go to college when I was young, but I had just gone back to college, and a lot of my teachers were telling me that I was a gifted writer, this type of thing, you know, mm-hmm. a scholarly writer, I should consider writing, you know, that type of thing, and that really bolstered my confidence that maybe I could pull it off.
Sure.
And I said, well, you know what? You know, I was working, had a child. I said, I'm not going to be able to research this, but if you wanted to try to write a book and let's do it together, then we'll try it. And I said, you know, but you'd have to pull together interviews, talk to people, and bring me back everything. And find any pictures you can find and that type of thing. And I said, well, you know, if it's meant to be, it'll be done and we'll do it. And if it's not meant to be, then we'll fail. But it's okay. You know, we'll just put one foot in front of the other and, you know, see what we come up about the story.
Sure.
And so that's kind of how it started. That book ended up being White Christmas, Bloody Christmas. And a lot of people know of that book and don't know about the subsequent book that I wrote that's much more enlarged. White Christmas, Bloody Christmas, it tried to sell. I mean, I didn't ever expect it to be a national bestseller. I mean, you know, we were doing it for the area, regional. But I remember having to argue with the first printing company that printed that book, and I had ordered 2,500 copies, and the president of that little printing company sat down with me and said, oh, you'll never sell these. You shouldn't print so many, and on and on and on, and just was really insulting almost. And I told him, I said, his name was Mr. Hall. I said, Mr. Hall, let me ask you something. I said, if I print these books and I pay you for it, it was fairly expensive for us to do this too. and I pay you for it, and they sit in my living room for the next 100 years, will it be of any concern to you? Well, long story short, we printed them. Much problems in printing that first printing. I mean, that printing company really messed things up. That's a story I could write a book about almost in itself. But anyhow, long story short, we got the 2,500 copies finally, and a newspaper article was written about the book coming out, and we had it as a consignment thing in a local bookstore in High Point the first time that it was sold. Well, people lined up, like, you know, hundreds at that little bookstore. And we had sold all 2,500 copies within 3 weeks.
Wow.
It's amazing. It was trying to sell like a bestseller, even though it was originally produced book.
Sure.
And anyhow, we went to a regular book printer, commercial book printer, and had subsequent runs of it done. And there was about, with overruns, it's probably close to 14,000 copies were done. I had a lot of trouble, you know, with selling it. I could write a book about everything that went
sure.
on. But anyhow, we had it printed more times, and as it was printed and more people got the book and read it and everything, then more and more information came to us after that first publication. It was like, wow, there's more here. More people know things. More people know somebody that could be interviewed, et cetera, et cetera. But I had so much trouble with this book, and we did get death threats and threats to be sued and all of that. And we sold that book completely through within about the first 3 or 4 years. Every copy we had. Now, you have to keep in mind that most books don't sell. Well, I had a professor tell me there was probably 50,000 books produced that year in 1990 or published, and only about 4% of them would ever in the history of the life of the book sell beyond 5,000 copies. And we eventually sold close to 14,000 in that 4 years.
Wow.
And so it actually put White Christmas, Bloody Christmas up in, you know, the top 4 or 5% of all books published that year as far as sales.
Sure.
With that statistic, if that guy was right, hopefully he was. He was a teacher, you know, of publishing and mm-hmm. writing.
It's very compelling. I mean, and I want to jump into what sort of information you received from the public after you published it. I want to talk more about just some of the difficulties you encountered. But before we even get to that point, let's fill the audience in a bit on what happened on that Christmas day where the family was murdered. Let's talk about that first, and then we'll
sure.
we'll dive into more of what information started to come out, what you discovered, but let's establish uh-huh. that first, because it sounds obviously very, very, you know, intriguing as to how this whole family mm-hmm. was killed. Factually, what happened on that Christmas day to the Lawson family?
Okay. Charlie Lawson, they called him Charlie. His name was Charles Davis Lawson. He was a tobacco farmer, just rural tobacco farmer in the foothills of North Carolina, and he was typical for that area. They were just outside of Winston-Salem, sold their tobaccos. Many people, neighbors around there, did. On Christmas Day in 1929, he, out of the blue, on that day, right after lunch, murdered his entire family, including his wife and all of his children. And the oldest child was 17. The youngest was 3 months. And it just took the it took the world by the heart, that he could do this, including my father, as we were talking about before, mm-hmm. That a father could murder his whole family like that, and not only murder them, but choose Christmas Day to do it. And so there was a lot of things that led up to it as we researched it. Everyone seemed to think he had gone crazy. He had an injury to his head back a couple years before the murders. People said, you know, that injury had caused him to go crazy. That didn't pan out in our research that was a cause. There was one son in all of this that he allowed to leave right before he began to kill the rest of the family, along with his cousin. His son was named Arthur, and he was like 16, and he and his cousin, his brother's child, Marion's brother's, was his brother, and his child was named Sanders. He had spent the night there that Christmas Eve and got up with them on Christmas morning. And for some reason, Charlie let Arthur and Sanders leave and go get more ammunition. Back then, this was very rural, and a lot of hunting was done for food. They had all been out rabbit hunting that morning, along with some other things that they were doing, like tossing up tin cans and, you know, doing target practice and this and that. Sure. And so that was a mystery in itself. Why would he kill all the other children and let Arthur go? And that's kind of hard for me to get into, you know, in an interview like this. But as we researched it, you begin to get theories as to why that happened and what was going on and everything. But the murders were very, very brutal. It's just so much detail. The second book, and I probably should mention this, the second book that I wrote, I didn't write it until 2006. It's called The Meaning of Our Tears. Mm-hmm. And I decided first to go with White Christmas, Bloody Christmas, because everybody said that would be the title. But I always wanted to title it The Meaning of Our Tears because of the epitaph.
Sure.
Not now, but in the coming years, you know, it'll be in better land. We'll read The Meaning of Our Tears. So now, 2006, I wrote The Meaning of Our Tears. And it's the first book is like 148 pages. Mm-hmm. And The Meaning of Our Tears is like 376 pages.
Sure.
So if you really want to know everything, it's the second book. If you want something that's highly collectible now, then The Meaning of White Christmas, Bloody Christmas is it. But, you know, that happened. It was brutal. He shot them with shotguns. He also used a rifle, and he also bludgeoned their heads. He came back and posed them. He put their heads on either rocks or pillows. The first two little girls, kind of like in the middle of the family, Carrie and Maybelle. Carrie was about 12 and Maybelle was about 7 or 8. They left the house that morning to go to their aunt and uncle's house, walking through the pastures and fields. He ambushed them at a tobacco barn, and this is so much little details that came out. One of them was shot with a shotgun, and one was shot with a rifle. And they were shot right together, walking up past that tobacco barn. And I always wondered why one with a shotgun and one with a rifle. Now, I think most of us realize what damage and carnage a shotgun does. And I doubt Charlie wanted to use a shotgun. Mm-hmm. So there was also these stories of him having his guns checked by a local gunsmith mm-hmm. right before the murders. There was talk of him being overly concerned about his guns, didn't want anybody to touch them. This type of thing went on in the weeks before the murders. So, and it was so funny, you know, you talk about paranormal and stuff like that. I always considered this strange. And one morning while I was writing The Meaning of Our Tears, I was listening to a talk radio program in the morning, you know, before I got up for work. Mm-hmm. And somebody was talking about guns and rifles and shotguns and things. And they started talking about this older model gun that had a history of jamming. And it was from that era. And I thought, that's it. That would explain. He was concerned about his guns. He had had them looked at and worked on. And then the morning of the shooting, one child is shot with a shotgun and the other child shot with a rifle. So he probably shot the first girl with a rifle and then it jammed. And he had the other gun with him, I guess, as a backup, or the shotgun with him, and used it on the second one. It's little things like this that came to me in writing all this. It's like, it's almost surreal. You know, I don't know that that happened, but I think it's reasonable.
Sure, assumptions based on the facts of what likely would have occurred.
Yeah.
Well, give me a little insight as to your knowledge, you know, leading up to this Christmas morning where he brutally took the lives of his entire family. Was there any evidence? I mean, was he acting strange? I mean, I know you mentioned or alluded to something you kind of debunked about the head injury, but what was this Charlie like as an individual? What did neighbors, what did friends, family say about him?
Right, that's a great question, and it helps me lead into it. As far as everyone knew, Charlie was a good person. He wasn't a churchgoer, but he was a good person. There were quotes of people who knew him saying he would give you the shirt off his back, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. There's a story in the book where a lady says her father had loaned him $2. Now, back then, $2 was a lot.
Sure.
Quite a bit more than now. But Charlie had gotten on his mule and ridden several miles to make sure he came back and paid him back. You know, so in the community, he was respected, and he was also a member of the Junior, see if I can remember how you say it, the Junior Order of American Mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a group of men that meet and things. I mean, he was known to be a good person. No one expected anything like this. So his reputation was very good, but he was also, some people said he was high-tempered. Now, there was a scandal going on, evidently, in the family, and that's where all the animosity from the family came from. They didn't want anybody writing about it or coming up with it. The neighbors, you know, they weren't too far from some of their neighbors. And they began that right before Christmas hearing the Lawson family out in the yard with some arguments and things. You couldn't really tell what they were saying, they said, but, you know, it was obviously arguing, heated arguments that they could hear going across the what they called the hollows in the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And so people became aware something wasn't right, maybe. But, you know, you don't think too much about it. People argue. When White Christmas, Bloody Christmas came out, I had that book completely written. We already knew what the scandal was in the story. But I knew it was going to turn that family upside down. And the niece of the murderer, her name was Stella Lawson Bowles. She was Charlie's brother's, Marion's, daughter. And back when we first interviewed her, I thought she was being vague some, but she told us a lot, and a lot of what we got came from her because she was right there right there in the midst of it. She's about 13 years old when it happened. She was there the day, you know, they were murdered, in the aftermath, standing out there in the cold with the fire with the surviving son. And that was her cousin. And I mean, she knew a lot. And I remember the very first time I went with my father to interview her, because he came back telling me some things that seemed, you know, very interesting about her. So, you know, sometimes I would go with him back up there and interview somebody because I wanted to talk to him myself. I remember walking away from her house after we interviewed her, and I told my father as we walked back to the car, I said, this lady knows something. She knows probably exactly what happened to cause him to do this. I said, but I don't think she'll ever tell anybody. Well, my father began to have a good friendship relationship with her, and when he'd go up there to talk to people, he'd go by and see her, that type of thing. Eventually, she decided she would tell him what happened. And what had happened is that she had found out from her Aunt Nina that Charlie had impregnated his oldest daughter, Marie. Not much is known about what all went on, what kind of relationship it was, you know, that type of thing. But that was really a big thing. Now, even after the Meeting by Tears came out, my late husband, who was married to me at the time, his office was in Asheboro, North Carolina. There's some Kim people who moved out in there. And an older gentleman called him because he knew the connection and told him that the night after the murders, that the family, which would have been probably Stella's father, Marion, called a big family meeting and at one of the homes of the relatives. And everybody came, and only those family members that were over 21 years old were allowed to be in the house to hear what was saying, mm-hmm. what was being said. Now, it's interesting that this guy was saying, this is not true. This incest angle is not true. That never happened. But why were they having a meeting and only people 21 years old? And what Stella told us was that there was a pact made. They got them all together and said, look, we don't want this to get out. And, you know, don't tell anybody, don't tell your children, mm-hmm. don't tell anybody that this happened. And now her Aunt Nina was in that meeting, and Aunt Nina, for Stella's Aunt Nina, told her about it several years later. And also, Stella had heard some people, some of the adults talking when she was like coming through a doorway at one time that gave her an indication, you know, that there was something like that happened. Now, everybody, when White Christmas Bloody Christmas came out, I was like, oh my, this is not going to go well, over well with the family and some of the people up there. And I debated whether or not to put it in there. And I said, I'm not putting it in there unless I can accredit this to where it came from, which was Stella. And also there was some other people that had heard rumors and things. But I said, okay, we're going to go back up there and talk to Stella one more time. And I had the entire book finished, and I had an ending without telling about this incest angle. And I let Stella read it, and mainly the ending of it. And what the original ending said was that we would never know really what was behind it and that type of thing. Well, after she read that first ending I had written, she said, you know what? people need to know what went on here. And I talked to her. I said, Stella, are you absolutely sure that you want to tell this? I said, you are really going to get, you know, hit with people not liking this in your family. She said no. She was probably 76 at the time.
Sure.
I think it was her age. She said, you know, it needs to come out what really happened. And I actually made her sign off, you know, that she had told me this type of thing. And I rewrote the ending.
Mm-hmm.
And with apprehension, we published it. And, of course, practically her entire family disowned her there for about 2 or 3 years. But anyhow, you know, it came out. Now, what was interesting, though, is really there was only a couple things that pointed to that. I remember telling my father way back when we were writing White Christmas, Bloody Christmas, and considering this angle to it, I said, if we could just find Marie's best friend or who she was, and she happened to still be alive, I bet you she knows something. But we never found her before White Christmas, Bloody Christmas was published.
Mm-hmm.
However, about 1992, after that book was published, and I was pretty much jaded by the whole process of trying to deal with the publishing industry. guess who my father found? He found one of Marie's best friends. And guess what she told?
What?
And she told about 2 weeks, and it's a chapter in The Meaning by Tears, about 2 weeks before the murders. Marie had spent the night with her. She lived really close to the school. They were good friends, and often she would spend the night. Marie would spend the night over there with her. I might ought to even read some of this because it's better than me just telling it, if I can find where it is. It was 2 weeks before the murder. Oh, and while I'm looking for that, another thing that Charlie Lawson did, there was a death right there in the neighborhood of a lady. And this is maybe a week or so before the murders. And all the neighbors, you know, you go to a wake. It was very cold. And the men had started a bonfire, like in a, I don't know if it was a metal can or something, outside the house, because the house was small and all the people who came couldn't really get in there to console that husband, you know, all at once. So the men were standing outside and warming their hands and that type of thing in front of that fire. And they began to talk about the meaning of life and, you know, that type of thing.
Sure.
You know, that you would talk about because someone had died. And they said Charlie was standing there in front of the fire warming his hands. And one of the statements he made was, I wouldn't mind dying if I could just take my family with me. And that was pretty telling because probably 10 days later, he killed them all. Another thing that Charlie did was about 2 weeks before the murders, he got the whole family together and took them into Winston-Salem and had a photograph made of the entire family. And it's really interesting. If he hadn't done that, I never found any other photographs of the family except that one. He went that day, took them all, bought them new clothes, and went to a professional photographer there in the downtown Winston-Salem and had, you know, portrait made of the entire family. And I think at that time, he knew what he was going to do, and he was photographing them for posterity, his beautiful family, you know. And it's really amazing. I mean, the photograph, if you see the original, you can count, you know, back then those photographs were so clear that they used. And you can see their eyelashes. It's so clear. If you see one of the originals, there's not many originals around. But we had that, and I don't know why I could never find any other pictures. I couldn't find school pictures or anything, but that photograph tells almost everything. Well, I have come up with inside the book here where Ella Mae Johnson was her name. Now, to protect her and her family, by the time I wrote this book, she was deceased. By the time I wrote, I call it Tears for the second one for short. And she was married, but I used her maiden name so people wouldn't chase down and harass her family. So her maiden name at the time and who she was at the time of this was Ella Mae Johnson. And this is one of her quotes. My father interviewed her by himself, and he wrote down everything. And both of them were deceased by the time I did White Christmas, Black Christmas. But this is what she said. It was only a week or two before Christmas that year. Marie asked her mother if it would be okay for her to spend the night with me. Marie and I often exchanged visits with each other. I was actually in Carrie's class at school, and Carrie and I were friends too, but Marie and I had formed a close friendship during that last school year. My family and I lived right next door to Shermanton School. Marie often went home to eat lunch with my mother and my family. So what happened was, that evening after they'd eaten, while they were clearing the supper dishes away, Ella Mae said that she thought she felt that Marie had gained some weight, but she didn't say anything until later that night when they laid down in the bed talking. And she said they chatted about school for a while. Then the conversation turned, and the girls kind of laid there quietly in the bed, and then Ella Mae asked her, Marie? And Marie said, yes. She says, you seem extra quiet tonight. And Marie didn't answer her. Are you okay? And then Marie, she said, began to cry. And Ella Mae propped up on her arm and squinted at her friend through the grayness and said, Marie, I'm going to start reading now for a minute. Marie, for heaven's sakes, what's wrong? It's hard to tell you. I don't know if I even should. Tell me what, Marie? Silence. Marie, you know I'm your friend. You know all the terrible, awful things that have happened to me, what my father done to me. You know you can tell me what's wrong. And I'll stop here and interject that Ella Mae Johnson was also molested by her father. Okay. Moving on in the book here, Marie was quiet another moment, then she spoke. Oh, Ella Mae, she blurted out in a jagged whisper, I'm pregnant. Oh, Marie, you can't be pregnant, but I am. I noticed tonight you looked a little heavy in the stomach, but I never dreamed. Oh, Ella Mae, what am I going to do? Marie whispered hoarsely. She swallowed her tears and tried to cry quietly so Ella Mae's family wouldn't hear her. Oh, my, Marie, I don't know, whispered Ella Mae, lying back down on the bed. Ella Mae looked up into the darkness and blinked in disbelief. She turned her face toward Marie and asked, whose baby is it? Marie was quietly sobbing beside her. Marie? Ella Mae asked again, who's the baby's daddy? Marie turned her head in Ella's direction. In the darkness, she whispered, oh, Ella Mae, it's my papa's baby. Ella Mae looked back toward the ceiling in stunned silence. She did, however, have reason to be sympathetic to Marie's plight, and she had a reason to have earned Marie's confidence. The prior year, 1928, Ella Mae lost her innocence to her own father. Her father had forced himself on her, and at the time, she had been able to talk to Marie. Their friendship had been a great comfort to her. Marie had been like an older sister. She she could talk to without worrying about what she might think of her. She never judged or blamed her. Unlike Marie, however, Ella Mae had never conceived a child. And I'll interject here, too. Ella Mae Johnson's father was put in prison for attacking or for molesting Ella Mae. And then what would continue on? Marie, don't worry. It'll be okay somehow. She whispered in an attempt to console her friend. No, sobbed Marie. I'm afraid it won't. Does your mother know? I don't know if she knows everything, but yes. She realized a few weeks ago I had missed my time twice already. She kept on asking me and asking me about it over and over and over. Why did you tell her? I just finally told her. Mama, if you must know, it's Papa's baby. Ella Mae muffled a gasp. What did she say? What could she say? I don't know, Ella Mae was silent for a moment. Does your father know yet? Yeah, he knows. What did he say? He said if I told anyone, especially Mama, there would be some killing done. Oh, Ella Mae, don't tell anyone. It can't get out, you hear? I don't know what would happen. And it goes on. I won't read the entire chapter, but at the very end of this chapter, I let the reader know that Ella Mae Johnson has said, I just couldn't believe what Marie told me that night.
That wraps up part one of our interview about White Christmas, Bloody Christmas with Trudy J. Smith. In part two of our interview, we're going to dive deeper into the paranormal happenings around the very site of that house to this day. What was the wood and remnants of the house used for after the tragedy that spirits may be attached to? Do you think the problems and discouragement encountered when printing the book had anything to do with the ghosts not wanting the story to be told? And what kind of supernatural encounters did Trudy encounter while trying to write the second edition of White Christmas, Bloody Christmas? It's a lot of very strange happenings that almost certainly point to some sort of intervention on the story. Until next time for the Grave Talks, I'm Tony Brisky. Thanks for listening.